Hello, welcome to Gentlemen Don't Get Caught, a podcast about the music of R.E.M. I'm Lynn, and I'm here with my friend...
Ali.
Hello. And we're here to talk about the fifth track on The Adventures in Hi-Fi, Ebo the Letter.
Yes, we are indeed.
Is it someone's name?
That. Yes. And do you know for why it is called that, Lynn,
no.
My good friend?
Do you? Is this a trick?
It's not a trick. Okay. I set it up like it's a trick, but...
Yeah.
So... An ebow is a magical device for playing a guitar. And I have coveted this thing since probably for like 20 years now. Not like constantly, because that would have been a nightmare to live with. Just being like, must have an ebow. So the idea is the ebit, like many things, is short for electronic. And then bow, it's like... a bow for a violin or something. So the idea is that you've got a guitar, now you have something to play. Instead of a plectrum, it's like a bow, except it's electronic. So what it does is it produces like a magnetic pulse that when you bring it close to the string, it vibrates the string without touching it.
Yeah.
So what it allows you to do is just like... hold it above a note and that will just like continuously vibrate the note. So instead of like striking the string, you're just having, okay, this will sound pervy, the string is just being stimulated.
Okay.
That did sound pervy, didn't it?
It would have sounded less pervy had you not pointed it out, I think. But there you go.
Well, just earning the E tag for this episode.
Quite.
Yes, so this is like, it's like a small, like, handheld device. We're still talking about the ebow here.
Okay.
Yeah, like, I think it costs about £100. So I should really, instead of just coveting it, just have bought it, because it's objectively not a huge sum of money.
Okay, yeah, I thought you were going to say it was, like, thousands and thousands of pounds.
No. Okay. No, it's...
I realize £100, that's not nothing, but in the scheme of 20 years, you would have thought you might be able to...
Yeah, scrape together some coins. Yeah, I think a lot of it comes down to, it's objectively not that much money, but it is quite a lot of money for essentially a guitar toy.
Okay, that's fair.
And I don't play nearly often enough to really justify going, oh yeah, well, this will go to the Ebo and not to like a deposit for a house.
Okay, fair enough.
So, or an interesting holiday or something like that. It's like, nope, guitar toy that I will use maybe twice a year.
This makes more sense now because I was like, had no one just heard of theremins? But theremins are quite expensive.
Theremins are quite expensive. And also, apparently, I am told, very, very, very difficult to get like the an exact pitch that you want. Mm-hmm. So, like... If you're just playing a theremin by itself, it's fine. But if you're trying to coordinate it with other instruments, then it's quite difficult to not just be off key.
Okay, that makes sense.
At least that's how I understand it. I have never actually. I have technically played on somebody else's cheap theremin, but like never had enough time to like get anywhere near good at it, but that would definitely be something I could not justify buying. Although I would find it fun. I think it would alienate me from my neighbors though, because
the advantage of being an electronic instrument is that I think you could probably stick headphones on.
Yeah, but where's the fun in that?
Well, that's fair. As someone who plays a banjo, I do struggle with this.
I'm trying to remember, are you in a semi-detached house?
Yeah.
Okay, so as long as you're over the other side of the house, it's fine. Or in the garden, but I realise that's difficult living in Scotland for it to be not completely inclement.
Oh, if I was in the garden, everyone would hear us, because all of our gardens are like mashed up together. It's all small gardens that back onto each other, so I think the sound would travel pretty well.
Yeah, and everyone would love that, because... The Scots, they're famous for their love of the banjo. That's
right.
I'm going to claim.
It's true.
Based on nothing. Right. So I feel like I have waffled extensively just it's about fine. The title and then random instruments.
Well, the title, and I don't think this is accidental, to be honest, although I don't know that for certain. The title relates to another song with a similarly derived title, Country Feedback, I think. And I feel like this song was, in my mind from vague anecdotes, has been compared or vaguely relates to or was written in a similar manner to Country Feedback.
It's a spiritual sequel.
Yeah.
I can see that. Yeah, I guess... Strangely, it hadn't occurred to me, but now that you say it, I'm like, well, that's, yeah, I should have figured that. It is quite reminiscent of that. Do you like one more than the other?
Yeah, I like Country Feedback better.
I thought you would probably say that.
But I do like Ebo the Letter.
Yeah, it's an interesting one, isn't it? Like, how would I describe it? I would say the mood is, like, dripping with ennui, like it's saturated to the point that it's just like it cannot contain any more ennui. It's just sweating ennui everywhere. Sorry, that was unpleasant, wasn't it? Oh man.
So now you've got me thinking, why do I like this slightly less than Country Feedback? And I think mostly it comes down to, I don't know, when it gets nearer the end, it repeats a lot, and it has a sort of backing vocal.
Do you not like the backing vocal?
Not particularly. It feels like the backing vocal on a lot of Leonard Cohen songs, particularly earlier Leonard Cohen songs. Though I don't really like those either.
The Cohen fans are coming for you, Lynn.
I think Leonard Cohen is an incredible songwriter. And I think there's often too much synth and too much backing vocal on a lot of Leonard Cohen's recordings for my tastes. But he can do what he likes because he's an incredible songwriter, so whatever.
Yeah, I can see that. I can definitely see that. And as somebody who grew up with, I'd say grew up with, like in my teens, my dad introduced me to his LP of Songs from a Room, which is from the 60s and is very pre-synth. So it's just him and a guitar. I think maybe is there some piano on that album? But it's very, very sparse. Then hearing like the original version of Hallelujah and just going,
yes,
like, what happened?
That's exactly what I was thinking of. It's when, like, I remember hearing that when it was still quite a famous song. And like, of course, I'd heard covers first, I guess.
Right.
That's being too young to have heard the original version of Hallelujah in the 70s. What was it? 84? Might be the 80s.
I think it might be 80s.
Might be 80s. Yeah. But yes, and then suddenly hearing it and going, what is this?
Just like, someone 80s'd all over this song.
Yeah, exactly.
And not in a good way.
Quite. So
yeah, I like the backing vocals on this quite a lot. And I was like, who is that? And funnily enough, I thought the backing vocals sounded kind of like vaguely sort of like gender ambiguous.
Yeah, I see what you mean.
And so So I was like, oh, who is it? And I was just like, okay, this is just going to bug me if I don't look it up. And apparently it's Patti Smith.
Okay.
Of like, I guess, 70s sort of punk-ish fame. And I think it's like really quite it's almost like scene stealing. There we go.
It's quite an affecting backing vocal. It's more that whole section that I think it goes on too long, it gets too repetitive and there's a bit much generally, but overall, rather than specifically the backing vocal.
I can't wait till we're talking about the next song then. if this one is too much, how would I even describe the music? Because we've hardly talked about that other than it's a bit long. It's very feedbacky, and that's sort of like what you have an Ebo for. But there's also like this kind of like pretty like, I don't know whether it's a sitar, but it certainly sounds kind of that ilk. It's kind of like this twinkly sound, but it sounds vaguely sort of Eastern. And it's just a nice little detail in there. I feel like we should move on to the lyrics of this thing, because this is a very lyric-stuffed song. In a good way.
Are you trying to say it's rambly? Because I think it is quite rambly.
Yeah, but it's kind of like rambly in a confident, stylish way. The thing that it brought to my mind, like, straight away was kind of like electric era Bob Dylan albums.
Okay.
Like, where he's decided, I'm not going to be earnest and serious anymore. I'm just going to be kind of flippant and weird, and just have this kind of like slightly sort of sneery offhand tone that's quite entertaining. So it kind of reminds me of that. I mean, it's not nearly as nasal as Bob Dylan, but it does have this kind of like brash kind of swaggery quality to it. I think my favorite line is hash bars, cherry mash, and tinfoil tiaras, dreaming of Maria Callas, whoever she is. Like, I just, like, that turn is just, I don't know what it is about it that's so funny, but it's just like, it just amuses me. And I'm just like, bravo, that is funny.
It's interesting you use the word flippant. I think I hadn't really thought of it that way, but I see what you mean. It's sort of rambly, like maybe trying to be profound. Maybe it is profound, but then it sort of throws it away in a level of self-awareness, I guess. I don't know.
There's so much kind of like sort of random, like odd turns of phrase and stuff that's like, what is this about? That it's kind of like, almost like slides the more sincere, heartfelt stuff like past you.
Yeah.
So you've got that sort of flippant offhand line, dreaming of Maria Callas, whoever she is. And then the next line is the really serious one, which is this fame thing, I don't get it.
Yes.
Which seems like a very direct, like, confessional thing.
Yeah, it's, you know, a lot of some of the other stuff seems to be, I don't know, obscure in some way. But yeah, then there's... Yeah, a sort of disarming amount of honesty and straightforwardness, like you say, which is not always present in a lot of R.E.M. stuff.
And I guess it must be quite weird to go from a, like, sort of college rock nerds have heard of you to then being like a, you're not like maybe movie star level famous, you're not like Brad Pitt famous, but anyone who has like a passing interest in like popular music in the 90s probably knows who you are. So that must be like quite a jolt, especially like to have been doing it that long. It's not even like you're a band that kind of blows up like within like 1 or 2 years of starting. You kind of have time to get used to being like an adult.
Yes.
Like you're not just like bands where they become famous when they're kind of like 20. You're not... I mean, it's probably better to like not be famous until you're in your 30s. It's probably like probably a bit more well-adjusted maybe, but yeah. But having been used to not being famous and then have it kind of thrust upon you when you're already fairly like well-established in what you're doing, that must be very strange.
Yeah.
And I kind of wonder with... the way, I guess, distribution and like fandoms and stuff work now, there's, I don't know whether in the sort of like rock slash indie world, someone like Michael Stipe would get as famous as Michael Stipe now, just because it seems like alternative slash indie music is just like, not as mainstream as it was in the 90s. Like now it seems like it's like more pop music is the mainstream norm, whereas the mainstream norm I think in the 90s seemed to have like a wider range of stuff. I may be talking nonsense.
No, I find it hard to say what the mainstream music is, but yeah, it doesn't feel like it's this
No.
It was mainly sort of like, say, sort of like early, I don't know, I guess early 90s was more like rave or something maybe. And then,
yeah,
and then sort of into indie and then fading out into, I don't know, whatever it was at the turn of the century.
Yeah.
Hip hop, remember?
Anything else interesting in the lyrics?
I've learned that aluminum tastes like fear.
Yeah.
Smells, yeah, tastes like fear. So I was going to say smells like fear. Smells like teen fear. Adrenaline pulls us near.
Oh, yeah, and we have the, I would lick your feet, but is that the sickest move? I have no idea what
move?
That's about.
Sick as in gross or sick as in, that was a pretty sick move. Like a cool move, I don't know.
Yeah, maybe.
It's not clear. More
know.
Ambiguity.
Yeah, that's their stock in trade. Maybe this is because it's the 90s and he's somehow pandering to Quentin Tarantino. That's what everyone was doing in the 90s.
Yeah, especially in the sort of mid to late 90s.
Yeah, he was apparently the coolest. Yeah. Weirdly, there is from around the same time, it's 1999, there was an adaptation of Alexander Pushkin's verse novel, Yevgeny Onegin.
Okay. Or,
as it's written down, Onegin. But the narrator of that story has a bit of a foot fetish. So in the movie adaptation, this means that Ralph Fiennes, who plays Onegin, licks somebody's feet in like the first 10 minutes.
Is that essential to the story?
No, it's not essential to the story, but it is true to the fact that like the narrator of the story keeps going on about how pretty someone's feet are. And okay. They just had to visualize it in a very obvious way.
Fair enough.
So now everyone has an image of Voldemort. Voldemort? Is he French?
Voldemort.
Voldemort!
Exactly.
Voldemort licking somebody's feet. Which actually, I mean, depending on their level of hygiene, maybe not having a nose is an advantage. Yeah, I don't know. This what's happened to this episode?
I don't know. like the song, we're just merely reflecting the style of the song.
Yeah, exactly. It's artistic interpretation.
Every one of these episodes is artistic interpretation of the song that we're reviewing, just in case that wasn't entirely clear to everyone.
Yeah, it's deliberate.
It's deliberate. It's all deliberate. On that note, that infinite Ebode note, it's time for us to go. But don't leave us. Come back for leave or something. Thanks, bye.
Turn on narrator, toggle switch on.
gdgcpodcast@gmail.com.
It doesn't sound as romantic and awesome as tape.